to fly. Bring me some peace when there's talk of war. I've got peace on my mind. Peace is sweet, most any time and yet. Bring me some peace when there's talk of war.
It's so easy
we forget.
Oh, thank you. I think that's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I got two jokes for you. The one is actually a story that a friend of mine told me. She was a sister in charge of the resources for teachers in Catholic schools up in Toronto. And she said she used to go over from her office occasionally to a local Catholic school nearby, a parochial school, and just see what was happening. I remember one day she said she met a little boy, and he was at the little bubbler, you know, taking a drink. And she'd kind of check and see what he'd been learning in his religion class. And she started out with that old question, which was the first one in our catechism when I was growing up. Maybe you said in the Lutheran catechism too, who made you? God made me. All right. And the next one was, why did God make you? To know him and love him and serve him in this world and be happy with him. And next. But anyway, so she asked this little boy, she says, well, after some conversation with him, she said, well, who made you? And it was apparently not a question he had really thought about in that catechetical form, but he paused, she said, and then he said, well, God made me little, but I grew the rest myself. Anyway, in the same school, she had an older teacher who was really trying to be with it now with all the new changes and the new textbooks and so on. And so her name was Miss Murphy, and she had been teaching for years and years. And she said one day she was in the hallway, and Miss Murphy came running down the hall, and she said, oh, Sister Elaine, she said, come here, I want to show you something in my classroom. She said, I've taught the children this little thing where we say a psalm, and I have them in two choirs, and the boys are in one choir and the girls in the other, and we trade sides. She thought that was a wonderful discovery she had made. You know, the monks did that for years. But anyway, she thought it was just so wonderful. So Elaine was always trying to support the teachers, so she went down, and she said, boy, the children just threw themselves into it, you know, and they did, it must have been Psalm 21, because it has that line, may goodness and mercy follow me all the years of my life. And she said, Elaine says she heard this little boy just as clear as he could saying it, and may good Miss Murphy follow me all the days. Good Miss Mercy. Well, then this is also a little joke, which I think it was a minister actually who would, during the Sunday school class, would pop in just a little bit, maybe ask the students one question or other, just to check how they were doing in their little classes before he'd go over for the services in the morning. And usually it was some question from the Bible, you know, see what they were learning and so on. But this one day he came in and he said, well, now, he said, I have a riddle for you today. He said, I want to ask you, what's gray and furry and has a big tail? And the children just sat there for a while. And finally, one little boy raised his hand. He said, well, it's probably Jesus, but it sure sounds like a squirrel to me. Well, so the first part of this talk today, I want to look at the text of Mark. And we're going to be talking about power, and of course how that's related to justice, but power. And I'm thinking particularly of the first reading on the Sunday, first Sunday of Lent, is the reading from the Gospel of Mark, and it's verses 9 to 15. Is that what you have, I think? Does anyone know? Chapter 1. I thought. Do you have that? Can you check that? Well, that's what some readings are for. Is it there? Can you check? I'm not sure of that, so
isn't that the reading from the baptism of Jesus?
Yes, right.
But we just had that.
So it can't be that one.
We have marked 1 through 12.
We just had, they went into...
12 through 15.
It's 12 through 15.
12 through 15.
12 through 15. Okay. All right, good. Okay, good. Well, what I'd like to share with you are some techniques for reading, which I've been working at, and you maybe are already aware of. But it really is trying to get a sense of the person of Jesus as developed by the writer of this gospel. Now, that's different than your own image of Jesus. And, you know, maybe I could even, if we have time to do this, but it'd be useful, say, to spend a little time having you write down your image of Jesus. You know, what's your image? I have students do this. I give them like 10 minutes in class, and I have them free write their image of Jesus. Really rather astounding, to tell you the truth. But anyway, but it's just good to say, well, now, what's your image of Jesus? Now, the reason I do that is that I want to make them aware that if they bring that image of Jesus into their reading of, say, a particular gospel, they're going to be really closing themselves off from the image of Jesus as it comes out of this writing. So those are two different things, and it's a different thing for all of us sitting here. We all have our image of Jesus, and then there's Mark's image of Jesus. So if there is a way in which we're going to really encounter the text, then we have to be aware that we can't read our Jesus into the text. Okay, so that's going to be our effort this afternoon. For at least the first half, it is to really look at the text of Mark and the image of Jesus that emerges out of that text. Okay, and then for the second part, I'd really like to look at the text of our lives that we're writing right now and what's involved in that process and how those two can hook up. And then we'll look at some text out of the work, out of that work, and so on, like we did this morning. You're so good the other day. You're so good at that I like to have you work with some text and then share that. So I'd like to begin with that, some suggestions to you. One is to see if we can slow down our reading, that is, line by line. Now, one way to do that is simply to focus on what the narrator of the gospel tells you before you go rushing on to the next thing, to really very slowly kind of like read a line and stop and think, well, now what do I learn from that? What's he telling me? Okay. Now, the narrator, remember, is a literary device within the text. The narrator is the one who is telling the story in the text. So it's not the author, but it's actually a literary device that is constructed by the author. All right. Now, what's interesting is that you as a reader know what the narrator is saying, but the characters in the story don't know. They don't hear the narrator. So there's a sense in which there are three layers within this text. There is you, and you hear all three layers in a sense. So you hear what the narrator is telling you, then you hear what the characters also say, and sometimes you can even hear what they're thinking, which other people around, other characters can't hear. Okay. Now, so one of the things here, see, we have a tendency to just, all those gospels kind of all run together. And I think we lose then the punch of a particular gospel or a particular saying or story if we aren't really careful and really concentrate. And I think there's a way in which we have to invite our students and parishioners to really become better readers of the text here. And that's a real discipline, but it's so wonderful to be able to do that because all kinds of things come out of that when you do it. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to slow down and let the text unfold. And we're going to just try and see how what image of Jesus begins to emerge from this text. Okay, so another little piece here would be this, and this is just so useful, to realize that the biblical narrator tells a truth, but doesn't tell the whole truth. So in other words, the narrator purposely withholds information so that as you enter in the process of reading, something happens. So it's very dangerous, or I shouldn't say that's over dramatic here. It's not useful when in a commentary a commentator tells you about something that's going to happen before or later in the gospel. Okay, there's a sense in which the gospel is supposed to unfold, and it's the experience of reading that changes. Of course, that's affecting you because that reading is taking side inside of you. So that if you give the ending, it's like giving the punchline at the beginning of the joke. Okay, so what's important is not, quote, the truths, if you will, in the text. What's true is the experience of the story unfolding and what happens in that process, what we learn in that process. So that's really, so it's important, huh? That little just thing you might remember. That the narrator tells the truth, but not the whole truth. Okay. That means that you enter into the story to try to make sense of it as it unfolds, and then you learn something as you do that about yourself and so on. Okay. Now, so we'll start with verse 9 because actually that's what I thought the reading was, and that's what I'm, so if we can just start there. And if it was the reading from last week, that's good too. So it says, it happened in those days. Now that's a conscious echo of the Old Testament text. It would be something like, in English, we would say, once upon a time. And that just that little phrase, you know what's going to come, huh? Kind of set. Oh, it's like the music that you hear in the beginning of a soap opera. In other words, what you have here is a form, a genre that's preparing you. It happened in those days, meaning this is like the stories you read in the scripture. And this is going to be that kind of story. So it's an echo there. Then it says that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee. And notice there's no title there, just says Jesus. That's his name. Be like Loy came from Oregon. In other words, it's just his, the name there. There's no title. Now, scholars get really caught up in all the titles of Jesus, you know. They can, but here, he's titleless, just Jesus. And then it says, from Nazareth of Galilee. Now, that's pretty interesting because Nazareth is the wrong place to be from. Galilee is not religiously significant within his own tradition. It's a put down. It's of no account. It's not the sort of thing you would tell people. You know, once in a while I say to students, where are you from? And they'll say, oh, it's just a little place in Montana. They don't even want to tell you because you're not going to know the place anyway, you know? So there's a sense in which the connotation of Nazareth, and particularly Galilee, is this is the backwoods. It's a place that you could say is unsophisticated. Right, exactly right. So that, and it's also a place that was associated with kind of riots and kind of insurgents and that sort of thing that get put down, okay? So in one sense, it has a kind of a bloody connotation of these people who don't know how to collaborate and get along with things, you know, that sort of thing. Now, just look how nicely that would read if it just said, it happened in those days that Jesus came and was baptized by John in the Jordan. That would have been just a better thing to say. We're talking about PR here. You know? And then it says, and was baptized in the Jordan by John. Now, was baptized. So Jesus is active, he comes, but he's passive. In this situation, he's the one who is baptized. So he's not the active one. He's not the one in charge here. Someone else is in charge. So he's really a receiver. He's playing that really passive role. So in one sense, the roles are reversed because right before this, you have John the Baptist. And it's really clear. I mean, what's so much fun is if you read about John in verses 4 to 8, guys, you learn a lot about John. I mean, he's a person of real significance and power. So says he, you know, appeared in the desert proclaiming a baptism repentance for the forgiveness of sins, and people, the whole Judean countryside and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, I mean, all those people were coming out to him, and they were baptized by him in the Jordan River. And here's Jesus, he comes along, he's baptized just like everyone else, you know, this is just a... That's what's so astounding about what the author is doing here, the narrator is doing. There's such a contrast now between John. You find out what he eats, you know. He's a person of real power. Yet he draws all these people. What a contrast to Jesus, who kind of slips in among the crowd almost. It's just interesting, the contrast that's brought there. So John is this kind of mover and shaker. He has tremendous strength. He's certainly mighty. And when he says in that line, "One mightier than I is coming after me," if you were John the Baptist, what would you mean when you said that? "One mightier than I is coming after me." How would you see that? I mean, he knows, certainly can count the people who's coming. So what is he thinking of?
A warrior.
Someone stronger even than he is, you know? I mean, he got all Judea. Boy, what would Jesus bring, or what would this other person come? In other words, this one would be true, that John the Baptist has a sense of his own strength and power. And when he says someone mightier than he is coming, he certainly has someone who's like himself, but even more than he is. He says, "I baptize with water, but this person coming along is going to baptize with the Spirit." It's kind of really strong images that's coming out of that. Mightier than I. So it is a kind of, you see that warrior energy in a sense, and there's even going to be a greater warrior coming along. One way you might imagine this for yourself is, imagine spending one day with John the Baptist. What would that be like, do you think?
Frenetic.
Yeah, okay. What are there some other images that come? Spend the whole day with him.
Wouldn't be peaceful. Exciting.
Pretty thunderous, wouldn't it? Kind of get those images. Pretty intense person. You'd have a sense of that, really intense.
Bring your own lunch.
You have to. Or a meal of solidarity. Right? I mean, you know, you'd be eating.
Yeah.
Just to be pretty stern, pretty austere. He's really. I mean, he's clothed in all these images of a prophet, someone who's really strong, but also who's, what do you call that?
He'd be chewing you out all the time, too.
You'd
be hearing gentle, kind words from him.
Yes.
He'd be calling you to shape up.
I think he'd be pretty strong, wouldn't he? Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like he kept himself pretty straight. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what would it be like to spend a day with Jesus? That'd be a nice contrast. Kind of person. I mean, we're just beginning here as we look at the text. Well, let's go a little further. It says, just if we look at images of power, in one sense, the first image of power is when it says, "As it is written in Isaiah the prophet." Now, Isaiah is not one of the 12 minor prophets here. Isaiah has a big name. He's a name person. You're dropping a big name when you drop him. Now it's a text, the force of the text. "Behold, I am sending my messenger ahead of you." Those are not, wimpy words. Those are pretty strong words. They're in control words, if you will, that come out of the text. So you hear the images of power, God in charge there, and then John the Baptist and the power. And then these words, Jesus came from Nazareth. It says, "I'm coming up out of the water." I want you to just spend a little time on what it feels like to be completely submerged. Maybe to be completely submerged. Because that's where it says, coming up out of the water, which means he was completely submerged in the water. What feelings come up for you if you imagined yourself that way, in that experience?
Panic.
Peace?
Panic.
Could be panic if you're afraid of water, okay?
Kind of a newness, breaking out.
breaking.
A new world, a start.
Okay. Yeah, there's a sense in which you went in, you were one person, you went completely down into the water, now you're coming up and you're something else, huh? It's kind of a sense of that. Transition, certainly. Any other?
That was nice food, didn't you?
Okay, could be, of course, it doesn't, so it's what's interesting about this text is that it doesn't give you an idea of any other people there, except that they say above there are crowds coming, so it could, there would be more crowds coming. So maybe you'd be just one in the crowd. That would be possible, too. You wouldn't be the only
person.
Okay, it's a sense of newness, cleanness, okay? Kind of like after a new shower, I mean, after a shower, you know, kind of changes you. Now, part of, again, is just trying to put ourselves into the text to know what that feeling is, and, again, not moving on, you know, but to really... Now, we don't read with very much imagination, so you got to spend some time doing this. Yeah, did I hear a remark? You know, you got to spend some really time doing this to feel what it'd be like to be in water and then coming up out of the water. Jesus. Then it says... And he saw the heavens being torn open. He saw. What does that mean? What does it mean to say he saw?
Well, he was probably the only one to see it.
He's the only one who saw this. Now, in other gospel accounts, it seems as if other people, but in this gospel, it's an experience that Jesus alone had.
What's the antecedent of the corona? Is it he or is it John or is it Jesus?
No, I think, and coming out of the water, it has to be okay. Jesus, because okay. He's the one being baptized there. I'm sure that's true in the text here. It's probably not even... he saw the heavens rent and the Holy Spirit. So it's in the verb is right in the noun, the pronoun is in the verb form. Okay. He saw the spirits being torn apart. Now it's interesting that the word for torn apart, which is the strongest word we've kind of come across so far in this text. Kind of an action word, a strong word there. It's the word schizo, schizomenos. The word that we use for schizophrenia, someone who has a split personality, we say. So it's a pretty dramatic word. So it's the heavens are split apart. And the spirit like a dove. Well, now, I don't know, but dove as an image just doesn't seem very strong, you know? You think of Pentecost, when the Spirit comes down upon those, and what's associated there with the Spirit coming?
Tongues of fire
and a mighty wind. But in this text, the Spirit comes like a dove. It's really... What's interesting, again, in that text is how that same image of a dove or of a hen brooding over the eggs, which is an image that comes in the book of Genesis in chapter 1 in the creation story. The word there in the creation story is of a hen that is hovering over the eggs. So it's really a pretty gentle image, if you will. Descending upon him, it says. And a voice came from the heavens, "You are my beloved Son, in you I am delighted." Again, what strikes me about that is that word of delight, to be pleased with someone. I think of what you see in the eyes of parents when they look at a child, what goes through their minds when they see this kind of little creature here and how wonderful it is. What comes to mind is tenderness, kind of a gentleness, if you will, that comes out of the song. Now, it seems to me that the narrator is really contrasting then the power of John the Baptist, which is a good power, it's a power for good, but is giving you the sense of how Jesus receives power and is going to use power in this gospel. So it's really interesting to see how...
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, isn't this the Christological sort of revelation? I mean, are they still saying that in the commentaries, that this is the moment of sort of revealing of Jesus' purpose, mission, and,
yes,
and nature and all that stuff?
Yeah, yeah. My own sense, of course, is that, again, when we talked about those three layers of which the text is sedimented in, you know, first of all, we have everyday facticity of everyday English language, you know, and then we have that metaphysical tradition, and that's really what I think often imposes itself upon the reading. They are the kind of propositional truths, so that we read all of this into the text, and it comes out of a theological framework rather than, I think, out of the images and the language of the text itself. So that part of the gift, it seems to me, of literary criticism today is to bring us back to kind of the images and the language, even the words, the softness of the words within the text. So that's where I think the literary makes a contribution to this. I would argue against developing a Christology so early in the text. Again, it imposes upon the text, again, a way that we go at Jesus that I think is pretty heavy-handed, theologically heavy-handed, if you think of this as early. Now, there is a lot of theology in this. It's simply not the kind of theology that we have developed with. It's pretty strong, categorical, and conceptual in the sense... This is really an action story in many ways. It's really a drama that unfolds of Jesus. But that's a good question. It makes a good contrast of this and what we make of this. But I would spend time, say, with God delighting in Jesus and what that means to delight, to take pleasure in someone, and what that moment is and how we have those moments too. The look of a friend upon a friend. What this song that we sang was about, roses and friendship and loving and all of those things. So we can contrast John the Baptist, who's certainly rough and ready, desert trained, if you will, a warrior, a voice in the wilderness, who gives not just a wake-up call, but a 10 siren alarm, you know? And the expectation is that Jesus will be like that, only more, right? And it starts out so much more gently. Then the next verse, verse 12, the Spirit now, who's like a dove and delight, connected with delight here, the word is ekbalein, kind of cast him out into the desert. Another kind of forceful word that comes out of the text. Now, that's the same word that's used when Jesus casts the money changers out of the temple. There's a certain sense that it has a force. And so it's just looking at really the language itself within the text. So Jesus is affirmed. He's, well, if we use Robert Blasel's, he has God who admires him. And then from that experience, he's sent out into the desert, where that identification now, he's going to have to struggle with. And what he's struggling with, it seems to me, is from his shadow side. What does it mean to be this favored and this loved one? And how will he use that? How will that change him now? And what will he do with that?
Mm-hmm. There's another note there, too, that just really struck me. And immediately,
yeah,
the Spirit drove him.
Yes.
No chance to revel in.
Yes.
in anything. Boom, out you go.
But it seems to me like the one thing I'm being struck by here is this, the Spirit driving him out is also that same force that I see in the heavens being torn apart. I mean, there is a tremendous power there.
Yes.
That
yes.
I think that takes away some of that passivity of that previous event.
Or you could say actually that that's one of the lessons that I think Christians really need to learn, is that it's not just a gentle Jesus, but it's also there's strength there. I think many Christians are afraid of power. As if there's something wrong with power. So we have a tendency either to go to one extreme or the other. So we have people who use power in this really strong way and think that there's never a gentle side to power. So in a certain sense, we need both of those terms and those images. Power is strong when it needs to be strong, but gentle also when it needs to be gentle. And so one of the things I certainly want out of this session is to say power is good, and we need to have power. And if Christians had more power, and I mean in the world, politically, and we're more politically astute, if you will, and use their power. I mean, we don't want Christians who don't have power, you know? Because there's certainly a lot of people out there using power. So we need to be empowered and to look at that and to see within the text. Now, what I want to do in the second part of this session today is say that we need to look not only at the light but at the shadow within ourselves. So that, yeah, you need both of those terms. I think that's really good to pick those out of the text. That's good. So I was just going to suggest to you, for instance, that Jesus would have been then trying to wrestle with and struggle with this experience and what that meant to him. In other words, he did not have an immediate revelation of the meaning of that experience. 40 days, which is, of course, evocative of the 40 years of his people struggling, okay? And then you can see where a commentary rushes in and says, you know, that they failed in the desert, but Jesus is going to be victorious. Maybe, but you don't know it at this point. And he doesn't know it at this point. See, that's where I think the narrative really should bring us new insights in this material and stop jumping ahead and always bringing up the ending, you know? It's like, he struggled, actually struggled. 40 days, it seems to me, is a long time to struggle, you know, concentrated struggle. And the struggle would have been, it seems to me, either being overconfident in what that would mean, or thinking, well, I'm just a poor carpenter from Nazareth. This couldn't mean that much, you know, and I couldn't be asked to do that much, you know. I'm just one person out there. And I mean, that's the other side of it, huh? And or if you think of Robert Moore in the where he talks about those energies on the plus side and on the negative side. Jesus would have to work that out. I think all too often we rob Jesus of his humanity in the text. When we pass over the stuff that really says he's human, he struggled, he was tempted. I mean, that was just wasn't, you know, put in there for fun. You know, it has a meaning in the text. And I think the role, too, of Satan there. Huh? Satan, I think, in that, as we find him, say, in the book of Job, the tester, the one who's going to test you. So you could hear Satan saying, well, you're really good. God, you know, you're good. You know, kind of lead you down that path. Huh? And then that strange line, he was among wild beasts, and the angels ministered to him. What strange images, huh? Strong images on one side, and I mean, it's hard to think of angels as being, like wild beasts. You wouldn't put those two together, would you? Wild beast and angels? And of course, commentators don't know what to make of it, but again, I think, reading from the text, I think that if you allowed your kind of imagination or your unconscious, not your imagination, but your unconscious, I think that might be a better source for trying to see what's going on in this text than, say, going back and reading Isaiah and saying, well, the strong animals will sit down with or lie with the weak animals, and, you know, kind of making something of that. I wonder whether the images really don't come up from the unconscious. And so that Jesus becomes a person who's at home with both wild animals and with angels. That in him, both the heaven and the earth find harmony. That he's at home as a human person among these wild beasts. And then the next line there, I just wrote some of these down here. After John had been arrested. Now the word there is really handed over. And that word throughout this gospel is going to be like a toll, a death toll. John the Baptist is handed over. And Jesus is going to tell his disciples that, there's even a text, I think, in 3 where it says, and they looked for a way to hand him over. Mm-hmm. So it's a shorthand way of saying, talking about his suffering and death. So what happened to John the Baptist is really going to happen to Jesus. And so it gives you a little sense of maybe that was what part of the struggle was here. Somehow this. Jesus came to Galilee proclaiming the gospel of God, the good news. Now one of the things that I think we're becoming more aware of today is how gospel really is a politically loaded word. It's not a church word. It's a word that was used by the emperors to announce the birth of their son, which means that the system is strong and running. That this emperor, this empire, is going to be staying in put a long way. So it's really a politically loaded word. And it's certainly, or the Christians knew when they chose that word, that they were using a word with political dynamite. But it's, of course, the good news, not of the emperor, but of God. It says, this is a time of fulfillment. Again, a really prophetic word. The kingdom of God is at hand. And now you can hear the politics coming out on this. This is another kind of reign or rule up against their own experience of civil authority. And then you remember the message of John the Baptist was to repent. But here it says, repent and believe in the good news. So there's something more here. It's not just repeating John the Baptist, but there's really something more here it has to do with the text. Now, yes?
Can you play a little bit for me with that? Now, after John was arrested, man, that can be loaded.
Yes. Well, notice what I would just like to you to become aware of is how, again, the narrator of this gospel is creating this story. He tells you that John has been handed over. Doesn't tell you what happens until chapter 6. But it's like months, and of course part of the loadedness might be that it was because John the Baptist was put into prison or handed over, that Jesus begins his own ministry. That perhaps the impetus for Jesus was coming out of that event.
Maybe right in the, almost a way of saying, right in the face of what they did to John the Baptist.
Yeah,
was spooky.
Yeah, right. Now that would be thinking narratively. Okay. That would be trying to really see how this story unfolds and how those pieces, and I think that's a really strong reading of that, really insightful. Mm-hmm. And why he needed 40 days to really come to terms with the meaning of this. How it prepared him for that. So you have Jesus who seems powerful in this text. I mean, he's not a weakling, and yet there's such a balance there within the story as it comes. Now, I think this whole gospel, I'm just starting this little part here, but you could go through the whole gospel that way and pick out those images of power, if you will, those kind of notions of power along. And then I think you'd see that this whole gospel is a long meditation on the use and abuse of power. The entire gospel is. And as Christians, then, we have a wonderful source here for coming to terms with power in our individual lives, in our relationships, and then as a community living in a world that so misuses power. So we would have images, if you will, and metaphors to begin to make a contribution to the world. And that's what this gospel really sees, that it has a contribution to make. Now, of course, when Mark is writing, that's a pretty small little ragtag community in the Roman Empire. It's not at all a situation where most people would say that most people in the United States are Christian. I mean, I'd be churchgoers, but this is considered a Christian nation. It's not at all the situation of this gospel. So then you can ask yourselves, well, has this gospel shaped the practice and the thought or the thinking about power in our churches? Is this where we draw our images for power, our sense of power? And is that the contribution we make? And of course, one of the things would be to ask ourselves whether, if we make obedience the primary virtue, whether, in fact, we have empowered people to live this message. I don't think obedience is the main virtue for a Christian. Yeah.
My question is, how are we talking about power? Is it the power coming down from God to Jesus, to the people of the church, or how are we talking about it?
Well, I mean, what I'm doing here is just really elementary in a sense of just seeing where power, I mean, I think you would see power in the words that are used here, God's voice coming down through this powerful text of Isaiah, empowering this, raising up this prophet John the Baptist, right? And then I think those are all power images. Now, what I would say then is not that power is bad, but how it's used or how it can be abused. So that power that is force against people. And he gives you some wonderful images of the abuse of power in this gospel. So that's, say, chapter 15, where you have all the trappings of imperial power. This is where Jesus is mocked and scourged, and they, you know, make the crown for him, and they put on. I mean, it's a real mockery, but the irony, of course, is that it really mocks all of those trappings of power as they were found within the Roman Empire. So that it seems to me anyone who really lives out of this gospel would never look at the trappings of power the same way. That some or other there would be built up a resistance to using power in that way. So there's that irony. So the first part of this gospel really presents Jesus as powerful, but never in the sense that he is able to make people do what he wants them to do. So that's what's so amazing about this. He has power to cure, to heal, to cast out demons, to quiet a storm. I mean, gosh, you know, these are really powerful things. But his own disciples can't understand, and he can't make them understand. Should give some of you a lot of courage here in your parishes, huh? As you're working with the people in your community or as teachers, huh? Or in relationships, how hard it is in a relationship. You cannot force the things that are really valuable. So you could say in this gospel, no matter Jesus, I mean, does all these wonderful things, huh? But in terms of his own discipleship, those that he spends the most time with, I mean, even teaches them in private. I mean, he You know, they get all these special side tutoring and so on. They just go downhill, you know? They just go downhill all the way. Yes?
I just have a question about, I've wondered about, you know, the world that, you know...
Healers? So Jesus wouldn't be the only one. And so he would share, I mean, again, I don't think this gospel is trying to say he's the only one or he's the best one. It just means that as a person, one of the powers he had would be as a folk healer. He had that power. But with this gospel, what he really connects that with, as we said the other day, is with teaching, that the power is within the teaching. So somehow or other, when you're taught something, something happens, and real teaching empowers. But, to me, it doesn't take anything away, again, from Jesus to say that there were others.
No.
You didn't mean that.
I was trying to think in terms of the worldview. Of,
yeah, the worldview.
Of the
readers
that would have read this.
Yeah.
You know, to us, you know.
It seems unusual.
It's, like, really vivid.
Yeah, right. Well, they might have still been quite moved by this, however, by Jesus' ability to do that, but they would have been moved by other stories too. In one sense, what has changed, of course, is that they lived in a real spirit world, you know, so the spirits above and the spirits below and so on, whereas we tend to be very skeptical about that. As I said, I think it gave them more of a range for talking than it does give us. I think that's good. Yeah, that's good. One of the texts, so if you followed through this gospel, and that would be just a wonderful thing, I think, as even a preacher to kind of work through that and come up with your own fresh stuff. Don't you always feel you got to say something fresh when you, you know, it has to be something that you've worked at and so on, and I think you can tell that. One of the scenes I'd like to go through that my students have a lot of trouble with is where Jesus is really portrayed as very powerful, is when he comes into Jerusalem. This is in chapter 11. You know, remember, he's come in to Jerusalem, and then I love this line where he comes in to Jerusalem, he looks around at the temple, and he goes home. Or not home, but he goes to, says, what does it say in the text there? To Bethany, huh? That's so wonderful. I just love that text, though. He looked around at everything. Like, you know, he came from Galilee. He said, oh, this is what they mean, you know, something like that. Since it was already late, went out to Bethany with the 12. Then it's that next scene that my students have so much trouble with. The next day as they were leaving Bethany, he was hungry. Seeing from a distance a fig tree in leaf, he went over to see if he could find anything on it. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves. Then there's kind of a little side note. It says, it was not the time for figs. Right. Now, the author probably added that because we know that this is about April because it's Passover time. Now, some scholars then argue that this may have been a story actually of something that happened with Jesus when it was harvest time. And that now the story has moved up to this part in the, because we know that this author took these very incidences and arranged them into a narrative, okay? So he kind of adds that. And even if he had not added, it was not the time for figs. Anyone who knows anything would know that this would be about April, mm-hmm. Passover time, and that's not when the figs would be. Anyway, and he said to it in reply, I think that's wonderful, Jesus not talking to a fig tree. And he says, may no one ever eat of your fruit again. So he gives it a curse. And his disciples heard it says. Then he goes into the temple. Here you see again some really strong, forceful language. He overturns the tables and the seats, and he doesn't let anyone come in carrying things through the temple. And then after that, goes back and it says, early in the morning, so he went back out of the city, early in the morning as they were walking along, they saw the fig tree withered to its roots. Now it's very strange to me, but my students say, really feel sorry for this fig tree. And I can't convince them not to feel sorry about it. But I will say that it seems very strange to me that they can feel sorry for the fig tree, but when they come to the line after that, which is 18, the chief priest and the scribes came to hear of it and were seeking a way to put him to death. They don't react. That's where the real violence is. See, Jesus doesn't lay his hand on anyone in the temple. The fig tree is actually a symbol of the temple. And just as a fig tree had leaves and looked like it had fruit, so the temple was a beautiful temple, but it was not fruitful. And he quotes the line there, which is that it was supposed to be a house of prayer for all nations. So that what Jesus' his whole ministry, and see, this is the nice thing. When you start at the beginning of this gospel and you just kind of work at it and just listen to the narrator. Huh? Put your Christology away and just listen to the narrator tell the story. What happens is you build up an image of Jesus and a sense of who this person is so that when you come to this part, it makes perfect sense. Here's someone who has spent his whole ministry drawing in those who had been excluded. So when he comes to what should be the heart of his religious tradition, and sees that instead of including, it excludes. Instead of being a place of centering, it's a place of business and transactions. He's outraged. He's outraged. But what he does doesn't hurt anyone. Now, would it have economic effect? Yes, by all means it would be. Just as if Christians, if we lived Christian lives and came out of those Christian images and in our churches lived out a different way of powering and being empowered, it would be very threatening to the political system in this country. In other words, there's a connection between the passivity in our churches and the passivity in civil life. If we have parishioners who are trained to trust their pastor and students who are supposed to trust their teachers, then you're going to have citizens who simply trust their leaders. And it's an easy way out. So what my students are really, I think what's interesting about this is what really offends them is this Jesus who's using power in this way. And they miss the really violent stuff in the text. Yes?
Oh, I was just thinking, maybe this isn't a real, the connection of Jesus being this human person who is so enraged, he can't control it any longer, and doesn't want to hurt anybody, so he wilts this tree.
But yeah, right. I think this is a time, and I do spend some time talking to my students on anger, and I think, again, anger is so misinterpreted, that anger is really a strong message to yourself that your values are being threatened. And it's again, the misuse of anger when it's misdirected. That's where I think the problem comes in. I can't see that Jesus misdirects his anger here, where the fig tree is useful as a symbol. He doesn't destroy the temple. He destroys the fig tree in kind of a prophetic act. Wouldn't it be wonderful if, say, President Bush did some kind of act like that and, say, destroyed a tree, if you will. Over against destroying an entire country, or Saddam the same way. In other words, what we have, it's just interesting to me that we have to come to terms with these symbolic acts. And I think in our own lives as well. There's a wonderful story. It's a book I would really invite you to read. and reflect on. It's by Richard Sennett. I talked to some of you the other day about this book. And the title is just Authority. It's an excellent, excellent book. And he says that the two primary images of authority in our own time are someone who's autonomous, someone who doesn't need anyone, that they have all the skills and power that they need to get the job done, they don't need anyone else, or of paternalism, someone who's going to take care of you and do what needs to be done. Okay, those are the two dominant images of authority in our institutions. But he tells this wonderful story about Madame Gide. Do you know André Gide, the French writer, was quite famous as a writer, and she was his childhood sweetheart, and they got married. But he also was homosexual, and now and then would have these weekends or these affairs, okay? And she tolerated for a long time. And he wrote her, from the time he was young, wrote her letters, like over thousands of letters that she had kept. Well, sometime into their married life, he was the tutor for the son of a local minister. And he had an affair with his son, and she was so offended by what she thought was an outrageous misuse of the trust that family had in him. He went off to England, I believe, on some kind of weekend trip or whatever, that while he was gone, she burned every one of the letters he had written her. And he himself said that his whole life was contained in those letters. But what she did was she effectively broke the chain, or the, what would you say, the power he had over her. She established her own value, if you will, in her own circle. And after that, she never again did any writing for him or took care of, you know, because she would do all of his, you know, typing, and she'd take care of all of that. From then on, she was her own person. She devoted herself to her church thing. She didn't leave him. She remained married to him. But from there. So it shows you, see, that there's a sense in which that's what breaks that hold, if you will, that she had. You know, he was a famous writer, and she was... he was her husband and so on. But there came a time when she owned her own power, and she used it, and she did not hurt him physically, you know, and they were her letters, but she made a statement, and it changed their relationship. Now, there's a sense in which that's a prophetic act. I mean, and we need acts like that in our own life when things have power over us that we know we need to break. So we need those. I mean, she created that ritual. It's a really wonderful way of doing that. So, yes.
It seems like he was also trying to show the disciples that he had the power to do more, a lot more, in the money lender's temple, but he declined to do so. It's almost as if he did use the fig tree for a sample of what is possible. Because he goes on to talk about forgiveness or have faith that what I say
yes
will be done.
Now, what follows there, interesting enough, after that, it says, line 21, Peter remembered, you know, what he had said, the curse before, and he said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered. Jesus said to them in reply, have faith in God. I think what follows from this really is, if the fig tree represents the temple and the temple is destroyed, then where are we going to go? So what follows is really, he says, Amen, I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be lifted up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, believes that what he says will happen, it will be done for him. In other words, the power will be in the prayer and not in the temple. Therefore, I tell you, all that you ask for in prayer, believe that you will receive it, and it will be yours. When you stand to pray, forgive anyone against whom you have a grievance, so that your heavenly Father may in turn forgive you your transgressions. So he really is giving a little pitch here on prayer, which is devoid of the context of the temple in the text. It's really interesting. So I don't know about your sense of whether this was a sample of what it could do. My own, what I would prefer is to say that it's an anger that's well-directed, it's controlled. It's not out of control. It's legitimate. It's a legitimate anger, you know, that's rightfully expressed. But it's certainly powerful. And we have to, I think, get people away from... Okay, well...
There's no connection probably between that and Jonah having his tree knocked down. And so God saying to him, you know, if you had as much sensitivity to the people that could potentially be destroyed by the message as you do for the tree, you'd be a good disciple for him.
No, but that's interesting. I'd like to think about that some more. You know, since one of the things that we're finding is that there are all these echoes, you know, within these biblical texts. You know, and sometimes that echo can be really valuable, and I'd have to think about that some more. I went over time, so now I have to quickly rush along. I want to share this little book to you, Robert Bly. It's called A Little Book on the Human Shadow. And it's just a wonderful little book, and I want to read what he says here. This is in chapter 2. It says, the long bag we drag behind us. So let's talk about the personal shadow first. When we were 1 or 2 years old, we had what we might visualize as a 360-degree personality. Or Robert Moore talks about having an entire piano board, a full piano board to play on, you know? How many, what's in a full, 88 keys? Okay, so you have 88 keys, you know, or you have a Crayola box with 150 colors in it, you know? You just have this full thing, okay? Energy radiated out from all parts of our body, and all parts of our psyche. A child running is a living globe of energy. We had a ball of energy, all right, but one day we noticed that our parents didn't like certain parts of that ball. They said things like, can't you be still? Or, it isn't nice to try and kill your brother. Behind us, we have an invisible bag. And the part of us our parents don't like, we, to keep our parents' love, put in the bag. By the time we go to school, our bag is quite large. Then our teachers have their say. Good children don't get angry over such small things. So we take our anger and put it in the bag. By the time my brother and I were 12 in Madison, Minnesota, we were known as the nice Bly boys. Our bags were already a mile long. Then we do a lot of bag stuffing in high school. This time it's no longer the evil grown-ups that pressure us, but people our own age. So the students' paranoia about grown-ups can be misplaced. I lied all through high school automatically to try to be more like the basketball players. Any part of me that was a little slow went into the bag. My sons are going through the process now. I watched my daughters, who were older, experience it. I noticed with dismay how much they put into the bag, but there was nothing their mother or I could do about it. Often my daughters seemed to make their decision on the issue of fashion and collective ideas of beauty, and they suffered as much damage from other girls as they did from men. So I maintain that out of a round globe of energy, the 21-year-old ends up with a slice. We'll imagine a man who has a thin slice left. The rest is in the bag. And we'll imagine that he meets a woman. Let's say they both are 24. She has a thin, elegant slice left. They join each other in a ceremony, and this union of two slices is called marriage. Even together, the two do not make up one person. Marriage, when the bag is large, entails loneliness during the honeymoon for that very reason. Of course, we all lie about it. How's your honeymoon? Oh, wonderful. How's yours? Different cultures fill the bag with different contents. In Christian culture, sexuality usually goes into the bag. With it goes much spontaneity. Marie-Louise von Franz warns us, on the other hand, not to sentimentalize primitive cultures by assuming that they have no bag at all. She says, in effect, that they have a different but sometimes even larger bag. They may put individuality into the bag, or inventiveness. What anthropologists know as participation mystique, or a mysterious communal mind, sounds lovely, but it can mean that tribal members all know exactly the same thing and no one knows anything else. Then he says this wonderful line, "It's possible that bags for all human beings are about the same size." Well, what I think is interesting about what he's saying is that if we just reflect then, we each have a shadow side or a bag. And it takes some work now as adults to go back and find out what we put into that bag. Because now we need that stuff. And we have a bag if we're Roman Catholic. I have certain things in there. And as a Lutheran, you have certain things. Or Episcopal, you have certain things. See, every group has a shadow. So you have a shadow. Your family had a shadow. If you grew up in a certain town, that town had a shadow. This group has a shadow. See, there are certain things. I mean, just think about it. Wouldn't it be true? There are certain things you don't do now because you're part of this group. Certain things that get put into the bag. Now, what Maya's saying is that's okay. I mean, you know, that's simply part of how we cope with life. What's not okay is that if you don't begin to come to terms with what you put into the bag, then you project that onto other people. So that as, say, Americans right now, instead of knowing what we put into the bag, we're projecting that onto people and making them our enemies. See, in a certain sense, our great dependence on oil is really in the shadow. We don't really want to talk about that. And the fact that they got all the oil. Talk about that. What we'll talk about is, say, democracy and freedom. So we have to kind of get in touch with what's in that bag. A wonderful quotation here from Carl Jung. He says, "If you imagine someone who is brave enough to withdraw all his projections, then you get an individual who is conscious of a pretty thick shadow." So if you want to know what's in your shadow, just think about all the things you hate about someone. You know, those are all the things in your shadow. "Such a person has saddled himself with new problems and conflicts. She has become a serious problem to herself. So she is now unable to say that they do this or that. They are wrong or they must be fought against. She lives in the house of gathering. Such a person knows that whatever is wrong in the world is in himself. And if he only learns to deal with his own shadow, he has done something real for the world. She has succeeded in shouldering at least an infinitesimal part of the gigantic unsolved social problems of our day." Come to terms with that, kind of with yourself. You know, you're bring a little light then into the social situation. I've been working out with you that kind of getting in touch with the gender part of our shadows in a certain sense, the expectations of men or as women and how that has affected us. And I wanted to read this poem. It's by Alan Friedman called "A Man and a Woman." And I think some of the stuff in the shadow comes up in this poem. I got this from one of my students. It says, "Between a man and a woman, the anger is greater. For each man would like to sleep in the arms of each woman, who would like to sleep in the arms of each man, if she trusted him not to be schizophrenic, if he trusted her not to be a hypochondriac, if she trusted him not to leave her too soon, if he trusted her not to hold him too long. And often women stare at the word men as if it lives in the word woman, as if each woman carries a man inside her and a woe, and has crying fits that last for days, not like the crying of a man which lasts a few seconds, and rips the throat like a claw. But because the pain differs much as the shape of the body, the woman takes the suffering of the man for selfishness, the man the woman's pain for helplessness, the woman's lack of it for hardness, the man's tenderness for deception, which is really fear, the man's fear for fickleness. Yet cars come off the bridge in rivers of light, each holding a man and a woman. There's a lot of stuff in there, isn't there? And of course, from a Jungian perspective, we all have both a male and a female side. So that in a culture that is male dominant, it means that not only women then are suppressed, but the woman or the feminine side of every man is suppressed. And if we have scriptures then that associate power only with men, or if we use texts that only associate power with men, then we just dig ourselves in deeper. So in the Gospel of Mark, when the author tells you that 12 were chosen and then 12 were sent out, he names more men than women all along, he's setting you up. Because when Jesus dies, the next line is, and there were women standing off from afar. Throughout his death, they saw the whole thing. They watched Joseph of Arimathea, where he put the body. And of course, the next day is a Sabbath. So they get what they need. They wait for the Sabbath to be over. And the first thing they do is head out to find the body of Jesus and to pay him those last respects. And they hear, in fact, that he has risen. And so they become the first apostles of death, resurrection. That's a powerful text for women. It's a text that they desperately need. Not so much in your churches, perhaps, but in the Roman Catholic tradition. And then you see not only the women, but others in that text of Mark have done the very things that the disciples were chosen to do. So that what was thought of as being unique to the 12 is not. Now again, what's interesting about the gospel is that what it says is it's from the unlikely places, the places you don't expect, that God comes into our lives. So the text is not, say, putting males down in order to put males up. It's saying we expect men to be strong. That's the cultural expectations. They weakened and they fall. And the women who we expect to be, you know, weak are the ones who are stalwart, who stand, who are there through the death, and who go out and are the first to hear about resurrection and are given the message to tell the disciples. So it's the reversal that's so interesting. So in our own lives, I think part of finding the shadow, part of reading these stories to find the shadow, is to say there's some really powerful stuff that's hidden inside you that your spirituality really needs, that you really need to tap into. And these stories can help you do that. By, I mean, in various ways. The disciples in this gospel, therefore, become a cipher for ourselves. Anyway, we have. You want to go about 10 minutes? We could do. I have two texts that I think we could work at that would be kind of fun. Or do you want to quit? It's up to you. What do we need to do here? It's 20 after. About 20 after. Should we do it? We could do it probably in 10 minutes. The two texts I have in mind is. The Transfiguration. okay? Some of you are working at that for a Sunday sermon. So that's in chapter 9. You could begin with verse 1 and go down to 13 if you want, or you could stop at 9. I think sometimes it goes from... Do you remember what the reading is on Sunday?
1 through 9.
1, 2, 2. Okay, so you could just, since we're... okay, now what I'd like you to do on that text is to look for the light and the shadow. What's, in other words, what the disciples are aware of and what they're not aware of. Okay. So it's looking at the text from another way. And then, what's the other text I had here? The man with the withered hand. That's in chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. Okay. So it would be finding kind of the light and the shadow in those texts. Okay. Is that... The withered hand is in chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. So if you get into little groups of, I don't know, three or so, or do you want to work at them together? Do you want to work at them together? Okay. Let's look at the one with the withered hand. Someone read that for us. About that. Someone? Yeah. Good. Did you read that for us? Good. Yeah, please.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Good.
This is the RSV.
Yeah.
Again, he entered the synagogue, and the man was there who had a withered hand. And they watched him to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come here." And he said to them, "Is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to heal?" But they were silent. And he looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him.
Okay, now, this is... a story that is scholars talk about it as being a controversy story. Okay. So I could ask you, what is the central, what's key to this story? What's an important?
Well, Jesus part. Is being set up.
Okay, but what's the kind of element that you need to have in the story? Otherwise, it won't fly. It's the center of the controversy.
What's lawful? Jewish law.
Sabbath. Okay, yeah. The Sabbath. Okay, so we can, yeah, that's what you probably meant. Okay, so now what I'm saying to you is something like this. Sabbath, the Sabbath law, and you can do this with any theological idea or image, any biblical image will work. And the reason is that every theological idea or every church law has it. There's always a dark side to a law or to a theological idea. So now we can look at this and we can say, what is the kind of, say, the light side? What's the glowing side of the Sabbath law?
Is there a space for God?
Okay, right. It's a space. Right. Space for God, okay.
Reverence,
okay. It's a way to reverence God. Is that an E there? Reverence.
Rest for the creatures of God.
What?
Rest for the creatures of God.
Rest, good. Rest for creatures.
In this text,
what?
Remembrance.
Okay, right. You could even say time for remembrance. Because actually the Sabbath is supposed to be remembrance of God as creator, okay, of all the things, all right? Anything else from this text particular that would be evoked about the Sabbath?
Life-giving?
Please?
Life-giving?
Is there a part of that text?
It just says, is it good to save life or to kill?
Well, now that gets into Jesus' stuff, but, which is he's getting at the shadow side. There's a certain side. But certainly Sabbath rest, and that would be that rest idea. That's really...
There's some community stuff in there, too.
Yeah, right, that synagogue. Huh? He entered the synagogue, so it's a time to be together.
Unity.
unity would be good, that's good, or togetherness. Now, I want you to see that these are all values. These are really important values there in the text. Anything else that you can kind of get out of that? Sometimes you have to kind of read this from, say, their point of view. What are they associating?
Order.
Please?
There'd be something about order and the society.
Yeah, that's good. That's real good. Right. Right, because in their rebuke of him, they say there's a time to do that, you know? So order is a big value. Gosh, isn't that a big value?
No, I'm not doing it right, not following the rules.
Yeah, I mean, you're disturbing the order of things. That's good. Anything else? Yes?
They're also keeping a commandment.
Right, there's a sense of obedience here. Huh? So they're keeping, as you say. Yes, keep holy the Sabbath. Is that number two? Or is that three? Three, isn't it? Thou shalt keep holy the Sabbath. Yeah. Well, I wasn't checking your. I think it's three. Okay, keep on keeping it. But yes, but that's important. There's a sense of fulfillment there, fulfilling a law, and all the kind of assurance that comes out of doing that.
Mm-hmm. We talked about being clean. You know, this person with withered hands, so maybe they were unclean.
Now, of course, this isn't the temple. This would be the synagogue, okay, which would be a little different. Mm-hmm. That is to say, the temple restricted who could come into it so that the lame and the blind couldn't come into it. Okay, there are certain rules about that. God being perfect, I don't want to see anyone else who wasn't perfect. I don't know where that comes from, but there's a sense in which there's restriction there. But he's in the synagogue here, but there's a sense in which probably they don't want to really notice that infirmity there. And it has some connection here, it seems to me. They certainly wouldn't want that to be upheld or pointed out or anything paid attention to it. Yes?
That's a very stupid question. What's the difference between synagogue and a temple?
Okay, well, now, the idea is that there's one temple in Jerusalem, and that really reflected that primary Jewish theology that there's one God. So that there's one God, therefore there's one temple, therefore in marriage the two become one flesh, so that kind of plays itself out on their kind of theological conceptions. Okay, so... yeah, right, okay. So, but you know how, and we could do more work in this, so you see how that would work. You kind of pull out all the good parts to the Sabbath law, all the things that are in the light here. You know, people giving up, coming together and praying together, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Now, what's the dark side of it?
Control.
Limitation.
All right,
limitation.
You confine God to his space.
Yeah. Confines God. Okay. Limits God. Would that be a way of saying what you said? Kind of limits God, puts God into a box, if you will.
I was thinking passive instead of.
Okay, right.
It's sort of a way to put down anybody that is outside the order.
Okay, right. It excludes. To say what?
Well, I don't know how the law is used, it seems. The way they're going to. Set up Jesus is.
It's abusive.
Abused.
Right. Legalistic.
Legalistic would be another way of saying it.
Unnatural. Unnatural.
You have to do double the work the day before in order to have the rest day.
See, you could see, in one way, you could see why they thought that Jesus could have cured this man the day before or the day after. So, why in this story is Jesus curing him on the Sabbath? Well, it's because he's trying to make a point about the meaning of the Sabbath. And it's in the text. What does he say? He gives you
the lawful on the Sabbath to be good or to be harm.
Right. That, as a matter of fact, to cure someone is to do good. To care for someone is to do good. In other words, Jesus is putting a person's need above church law.
Although it's interesting that it is something like a withered hand, because surely they could have waited another day. It wasn't some, you know, like hemorrhaging might be a little more critical.
Yeah, right. You know. I mean, it is true. I mean, he's had this, but notice how, therefore, it's well selected.
Yeah.
You know, there's a sense in which he raises that issue, a really strong issue, to it. It also means that, of course, the man is restored then to being able to provide his own livelihood. Right. Up until that time, he would have been really limited. So the restoration of his life and of his hand, in many ways, is a restoration of his life, because now he's able to work again. Of course, the point is that that's what God, in fact, would do. That if we honor God by the Sabbath, Jesus is saying, how better way to honor God than restoring life? You know, and restoring this man to his ability to work, and to provide, and to be involved, and to be active, so that it has it on that side. But see, all of that part of it, in a certain sense, they had put all that in the dark. In other words, they raised up this and didn't see that by doing that, how they understood it was to put this. And of course, that's because, right, this came down to be no work at all, and curing was work. But now Jesus says, but there is work that in fact gives glory to God. Yes?
The Sabbath carried with it kind of a, you know, everything was completed in creation, now we rest. So there's a completeness of
yes.
the Sabbath.
Yes.
Is Jesus also saying, there's something more? There's something new happening.
I don't know. I have to think about that. That's a good question. I think in one way, one would have to imagine what Jesus would have thought about the Sabbath growing up. Mm-hmm. And kind of live through that experience. I mean, that's the number one Jewish feast day is the Sabbath. That's really very, very precious and important to them. And you almost have to enter into that sympathetically to see. But it seems to me it's a wonderful story to show how Jesus is showing the shadow side of that. But they're paying a price for saying that the way to honor God on the Sabbath is to do no work whatever.
I forgot the original reason for having it. Love, to love God.
Yeah, right. But, you know, I suppose that would be true of every law. In one sense, one of the biggest, probably, complaints against early Christians was that they tended to relativize the laws, you know, whereas we tend to make them into absolutes.